Queria ser mais do que um sinal horário das 23 horas.
Queria ser profissional, passar uma hora mais tardia. Ser como a Pantera Negra, um maestro.
Um maestro não, um sinal horário pontual e com garra. Perguntam-nos o que temos em comum. Uma frequência de 107.9, onde encontras pessoas que nem imaginas que existem.
A secção de fotografia da AC e o Turismo de Coimbra apresentam Contactos Fotográficos. De 4 de julho a 31 de agosto. Exposições, workshops, palestras, projeções multimédia e ciclo-cinema Provas de Contacto, a partir de uma ideia de William Klein, com o apoio RUC.
Primeiro jogo de pré-época, Rio Ave 0, Aves 0. Eu não tinha grandes expectativas quanto ao jogo e confirmou-se que há muito caminho a percorrer até ao início da época. A primeira parte foi enfadonha e jogada a um ritmo lento. A segunda foi mais animada. Depois o Carlos Brito misturou por completo os jogadores nas duas equipas que fez alinhar e optou por jogar sempre em 4-3-3.
RUC, a minha mãe gosta.
Volta para a segunda hora desta emissão de Preto no Branco, dedicada aos sons da propaganda difundida na Segunda Guerra Mundial. Por aqui o tom de resistência e revolta dos norte-americanos mantém-se, portanto. Desta vez vamos ouvir a série You Can't Do Business with Hitler. Os conteúdos são produzidos a partir da experiência de Douglas Miller, que viveu em Berlim durante a década de 1930, como adito da embaixada norte-americana, e utilizou essa experiência para descrever as técnicas de pilhagem utilizadas pelo Terceiro Reich nos territórios conquistados. A música que vamos ouvir entre os diferentes episódios desta série data de 1994, mais uma orquestra, tal como na primeira parte do Preto no Branco de hoje, mas desta vez a Glenn Miller Orchestra. Para começar, ficamos com o primeiro episódio de You Can't Do Business with Hitler. Chama-se Heads They Win, Tails We Lose.
You can't do business with Hitler.
We are now at war. There are but two alternatives, total victory or total defeat. There can be no such thing as a military stalemate that would result in the survival of Hitlerism. That is the opinion of a man who knows, Douglas Miller, for 15 years commercial attaché to the American Embassy in Berlin, presenting a new radio series adapted from Mr. Miller's book, You Can't Do Business with Hitler, Episode 1. Heads they win, tails we lose.
This is Douglas Miller speaking. I'll be very blunt and to the point. I want to give you a picture of Nazi trade methods and Nazi business methods as I saw them during my 15 years in Berlin. I have two reasons for so doing. First, to tell you some of the causes of this war that you perhaps have never heard of before. Second, to convince you, if you need convincing, that there can never be any compromise with Hitlerism. We wipe it out, or it wipes us out. Now let's get on to cases. The case of James Dunning Forrester, for example. Forrester was an American businessman who back in 1937 was trying to do business with Germany. He had nearly completed a deal to sell a shipload of American goods to the Nazis. To close the deal, Forrester was asked to call upon an important Nazi official at the Ministry of Economics in Berlin.
And now, Herr Forrester, there are just a few things more to settle, and we conclude your business.
But I thought everything was settled.
Not quite everything, Herr Forrester. There is the matter of shipping.
But my firm will take care of that naturally.
Yeah, of course. But we expect that you will ship your goods on a German ship.
I'm sorry, I'm afraid that's impossible. My company has a contract with an American line. You see, we...
Then the contract must be broken.
I beg your pardon.
I mean, Herr Förster, that our regulations demand that your goods be shipped on a German vessel. Otherwise, your business with us must be canceled.
But why should I put American seamen out of a job?
Regulations, Herr Förster, regulations. There's nothing I can do about it, you understand.
Well, I suppose it could be arranged, but I don't like it very well.
Now, another thing, Herr Förster. Are you insured with an American company?
You needn't worry about insurance, Herr Schwartz. The company I'm insured
with... Is it an American company, Herr Forrester?
Naturally.
Unfortunate.
I don't understand.
When our regulations demand you insure with a German company.
Why, that's ridiculous. After all, I'm the one who stands to lose if anything happens. I think I should have the right to insure myself with an insurance company of my own choosing.
Herr Forrester, are you implying that German insurance companies are not dependable?
I'm implying nothing of the kind. Look here, Herr Schwartz. We'll forget this insurance matter for the moment. But how many other regulations do I have to conform to?
Well, when your cargo is loaded in America, it must be examined by German inspectors.
German inspectors, eh? Well, that's all right with me.
Your company, of course, must pay the expense of sending these inspectors from Germany to America and back again.
Now, wait a minute. Why should we pay the expenses of men who are working in your interest?
I never heard of such a thing. Herr Forrester, if you wish to do business with Germany, you must do it according to German regulations.
No other country has such arbitrary regulations.
The Great Reich, Herr Forrester, is not responsible for the regulations of other countries.
That's some consolation.
I beg your pardon.
Never mind. Let's get on with it.
And that's the way the Nazis do business. There's no such thing as having a purely business relation with a totalitarian state. Every business deal carries with it political, military, social, and propaganda implications. Proof? I have plenty of proof. For example, about 3 years ago, Goebbels' Ministry of Propaganda arranged for the president of the German Film Chamber to visit my office to discuss an exchange of motion pictures. After this high Nazi official had arrived and we had exchanged a few pleasantries, he said to me,
Herr Miller, Dr. Goebbels is interested in buying American motion pictures. The few that we have shown have been very popular here.
Yes, yes, of course. But am I to understand that the American film companies will be paid cash for these films?
Cash? Yeah, of course. What else?
Well, isn't it a bit unusual? Usually you do business on a barter basis.
Yeah, but this is different.
And will the American firms be able to take their profits out of Germany? That is, without the usual restrictions, I mean?
There will be no restrictions.
Well, I'm very glad to hear it. But why are you waiving the standard regulations?
Ah, but we are very friendly to America.
Oh, I see. This is a gesture of goodwill.
Yeah, goodwill. That's it. Oh, of course, we would expect some little favor in exchange.
Oh, I see. And what is the nature of the favor?
Well, Herr Goebbels would like each of the large motion picture theaters in 25 of your leading American cities to give one quarter of their time to us.
You mean Herr Goebbels would like to supply Americans with motion pictures in these cities?
Yeah, that is, the Ministry of Propaganda would supply the picture.
Oh, but you don't understand. The United States government has no power to force American motion picture houses to show German propaganda films. Or any other films, for that matter.
The United States government hasn't the power. Oh, come, come, Herr Miller, you are joking, yeah?
No, no, seriously. American movie houses show what films they choose to show.
But I cannot believe it.
It's according to an old American principle, freedom of speech.
I have never heard of such a thing. Herr Miller, if you do not agree to our arrangement, Herr Goebbels will be very displeased.
Yes, but if I do agree to such an arrangement, I'm afraid the American people will be very much displeased. And after all, they're the ones who would have to look at Herr Goebbels' films. So you see, the Nazis were very willing to do business with us if they could in exchange flood American theaters with their Nazi propaganda. Because American movie producers refused to agree to the Nazis' outrageous demands, the Nazis deliberately set out to ruin our movie business in Germany.
proof. There you are. In 1932, we sold Germany almost 3.5 million feet of film. In 1938, because of Nazi restrictions, we were sending to Germany less than 0.5 million feet of film per year. Anyone caring to check these figures will find them in a publication of the United States Department of Commerce entitled Foreign Commerce and Navigation. Send for it and see for yourself. Sometime after my experience in the film transaction, Herr Goebbels approached another American official in Berlin. At that time, Germany was trying to gain the favor of American newspapers and radio stations. Here's what Herr Goebbels said to our embassy official on that occasion.
Sir, I am very pained at the insults offered to our leader in your American newspapers and your American radio broadcasts. I see no reason why we cannot have an understanding about such things.
What do you suggest?
As a friendly gesture, I suggest that you select any German journalist or radio announcer who, in your opinion, has made remarks insulting to the United States. I promise you that I will arrest the offending person within 24 hours. Furthermore, I shall see that he is punished in any way you see fit. Now, why can't we have the same friendly cooperation on the part of the American government?
Can you imagine our government permitting any foreign government to point out offending American journalists or radio broadcasters and suggesting their arrest? Yet Germany was treating us very well compared to the way she treated smaller countries who were powerless to resist. Let me tell you what happened to Swedish firms doing business with the Nazis. One day in the office of the president of one of these Swedish firms...
Mr. President, this letter...
Never mind that now, Carlson. I called you in here to discuss something very important.
But this letter is urgent, Mr. President. You must look at it right
away. Please, Carlson, listen to me.
But, sir...
Carlson, I want to talk to you about a personal matter. Now, will you please sit down here?
Oh, very well, sir.
Carlson, how long have you been working for me?
How long? Let me see. 21 years?
21 years. I don't have to tell you, Carlson, that you've been one of my most loyal employees.
Is there something the matter, Mr. President?
No, nothing. No. Well, have you thought of retiring, Carlson, on a pension, I mean?
Oh, Mr. President, is this all you have to speak of, my career? No, sir. I have 10 good years in me yet for the company. Now, this letter, Mr. President, you must look at it. It is from the Berlin Secret Police.
Gestapo?
Yes. They demand that we stop advertising our goods in the local newspaper. What right have they to ask such a thing? The best newspaper. We've been advertising in it for years.
You don't understand, Carlson. The paper in which we advertise is pro-democratic. And this is the Nazi method of striking out at their enemies. Well, they're using us as a tool.
But we won't do it. You tell them, sir. You tell them we won't do it.
I can't tell them that, Carlson. If I refuse, it means ruin.
You must refuse.
But you don't understand. We're in their hands. You see, we've come to depend on it. Now, if only I hadn't permitted myself to be led into such a position. And one demand after another. I thought I could play along with them and still maintain our independence. I was wrong.
Don't give in to them, sir. You must make a stand somewhere.
No, it's settled, Carlson. You make all necessary changes and see that our advertising contract is transferred elsewhere.
Very well, Mr. President. If that's your order. Now, I'll go back to my office.
Carlson, wait.
Yes, sir?
This other matter, your resignation.
But I'm not ready to resign, Mr. President.
Please, now, I'll be very frank with you. I received another letter from the German secret police that I haven't told you about.
Another letter?
Yes. Remember a few months ago, they asked me to send them a complete list of all the workers here? Well, they've checked that list with their spies here in Sweden, and now they demand that I discharge certain employees.
Discharge employees? But why?
Now, the Nazis say they're Jewish and communistic. Of course, these are the names the Nazis apply to anyone opposed to fascism.
Will discharge these employees, then?
I must. But I wanted you to understand.
That's all, Mr. President.
No, it's not all. There's one more thing.
Yes?
Carson, your name is among those the Nazis demanded I discharge.
My name?
Yes, because you have openly stated your hatred of the Nazis. Now, of course, you understand you'll be pensioned. You don't have to worry about your wife or your
children. You needn't discharge me. I shall save you the trouble. Any man who would work here is a traitor to his country. I resign.
Oh, don't go on like that, Carson. You must understand my position. Carson, wait. Carson, please come back here.
Carson. I have given you, in the short time available, some faint idea of the viciousness of Nazi business methods. Germany has been carrying on a war against America since 1933. A war of trade, a war of espionage, a war of propaganda. We must finish this once and for all, so that Hitler's cutthroat business and propaganda methods will never again sap our strength. We must carry on this war until Nazism is completely and finally exterminated. You can't do business with Hitler. You have been listening to the first broadcast in a new radio series entitled You Can't Do Business with Hitler. Listen for the second broadcast in this series, which is entitled Broken Promises. This program, written and produced by Frank Telford, is brought to you by the Office for Emergency Management in Washington.
Drum erspare mir den kann genau wie glücklich ich war, hör ich den Klang der Gitarre, hör ich den Klang der Gitarre.
In the survival of Hitlerism. That is the opinion of a man who knows. Douglas Miller, for 15 years commercial attaché to the American Embassy in Berlin, presenting a radio series adapted from Mr. Miller's book, You Can't Do Business with Hitler. Episode 2, Broken Promises.
This is Douglas Miller speaking. To win this war, we must do more than defeat the armies and navies of the Axis powers. We have to exterminate the Nazi Party. You can't kill a weed unless you pull out the roots. The Nazis must never again be able to carry on the same vicious kind of propaganda and trade attack they used before this war started. I said trade attack. I mean by that international trade, as the Nazis practice it, is a weapon. A weapon to soften up enemies for the military blitzkrieg to follow. And during the six-year period leading up to the outbreak of the war in 1939, the Nazis continually tried to sabotage American business in Europe. Here's how the Nazis worked it. Consider, for example, the case of Martin T. Johnson. Johnson represented an American firm that had been importing lard into Germany and other parts of Europe. One day in 1934, he came to my office in Berlin.
Mr. Miller! I'm heartily fed up with the way Nazis treat American businessmen. The word of a Nazi? No better than that of a low-grade racketeer.
Tell me what's the trouble. I'll see what I can do.
The Nazis are permitting us to import lard into Germany only up to a quota of 40%, aren't they?
Yes. In other words, only 40% as much as you used to import.
Sure. And remember when we kicked about getting cut down so low? The Nazis said that every other country was getting the same treatment.
True enough. The Nazis have a commercial treaty with the United States government promising not to discriminate against American businessmen.
What would you say if I told you that the Nazis have deliberately broken that treaty?
Broken the treaty? Well, how do you know that?
Because I've got the goods on them. Here. Take a look at this magazine article.
Let me see. According to the secret treaty, the German Reich has granted Danish exporters the right to... Well, say, what is this?
That's a Danish agricultural magazine. And what you're reading is the text of a secret agreement the Nazis have with Denmark, granting them the right to import lard up to 65% of the quota.
Yes, it's right here in cold print.
Mr. Miller, this is rank discrimination. The Nazis promise us equal treatment, and then sneak off and make a secret agreement on the side. Can't you do something about it?
Well, as commercial attaché of the American Embassy, I can protest to the German Foreign Office. I seem to be forever protesting and getting nowhere.
Could I be present when you make the protest?
Yes, that can be arranged.
Of course. I tell you what we'll do, Mr. Johnson.
The following day, Mr. Johnson and I called at the German Foreign Office. We were ushered into the presence of a certain Nazi official.
But I assure you, Herr Miller, this company of Mr. Johnson's is being treated as fairly as those of any other country.
I don't think so, Herr Hoffman. You're only permitting Mr. Johnson to import lard up to 40% of the quota. I happen to know you're letting the Danes import lard up to 65% of the quota. Do you call that fair treatment?
Nine, Herr Miller. That is preposterous. No such discrimination exists.
Mr. Johnson, show Herr Hoffman that magazine article.
With pleasure. Take a look at this, Herr Hoffman.
But what is it?
It's the text of your secret agreement with Denmark. That's what it is.
A secret treaty with Denmark?
Haven't you ever seen that treaty before, Herr Hoffman?
Well, now that you mention it, Herr Miller, I have the up. In fact, I have a copy right here in my desk.
So you knew right along then. This is the dirtiest piece of underhanded crookedness I've ever seen.
Herr Johnson, I am deeply shocked.
Herr Hoffman, you must understand that Mr. Johnson is thinking of the interests of his American investors.
Yeah, I understand that.
But... Oh, then you admit your government has flagrantly disregarded his promise.
Well, I don't know, but...
The point is this, Herr Hoffman. What would you advise us to do now?
I suppose you can submit a protest.
I've already submitted a number of protests, most of which weren't even answered.
Well, that is the only advice I can give you.
Well, then, thank you, Herr Hoffman. Come, Mr. Johnson, I think we better run along.
Yes, I suppose so.
Herr Miller, just a moment.
Yes?
You and I have always been friendly, Herr Miller. I hope this little incident will not disturb our personal relationship. After all, you understand that. Well, you understand I must make a living somehow.
Well, Hitler, come and see me again. Any time I can help you, gentlemen.
Good day, Herr Hoffman.
Well, Mr. Miller, that's that, I guess.
I'm afraid so. I'm sorry I couldn't help you, Mr. Johnson.
No, that's all right. It represents a loss of millions of dollars for my company. But after all, you're not responsible.
There's only one thing to do, Mr. Johnson, and if I were you, I'd do it.
What's that?
Get out of Germany and stay out. You might as well face it. You can't do business with Hitler. And that's what happened to Mr. Johnson. This case is typical of hundreds of others. Sounds unbelievable, doesn't it? But if you want proof, get the September 1940 issue of the Annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science. Turn to page 51 and read how, because of the Nazis' treacherous tactics, lard exports from America to Germany dropped from 93,000 tons in 1929 to a mere 55 tons by 1937. Remember, when you're dealing with the Nazis, you're dealing with men who will use any gangster method to get the best of you. Blackmail, for instance. A favorite Nazi device. I remember the representative of a soft drink firm who came to my office. Mr. Miller, my firm is having trouble with the Nazi authorities.
I'm afraid there are a lot of people in that boat, Mr. Hartman.
We were doing fine before Hitler came to power, but we've had nothing but trouble since.
But what kind of trouble are you having?
Well, the Nazis have forced German doctors to testify that the soft drink we turn out is injurious to health.
And it isn't, of course.
Certainly not. We've also had trouble with the police. They demand we tear down some of our buildings. They say they don't measure up to the building code.
Well, Mr. Hartman, here's what probably has happened. German soft drink manufacturers no doubt have their representatives in the German Ministry of Economics. This is their way of driving you out and getting all the business for themselves.
But it's unfair.
Obviously.
But you're not in America now, Mr. Hartman. You're in Nazi Germany.
But can't anything be done?
Well, like, I'll get in touch with the Nazi party and see. And maybe it'll cost you quite a bit of money.
And I'm willing to pay quite a bit of money. It's either that or go completely broke.
So I contacted the Nazi party. I was told they would take care of Mr. Hartman's case. About a week later...
Mr. Miller, there's a Carl Kenner here to see you.
Kenner? I don't know any Carl Kenner.
He's a member of the Nazi party. All decked out in a beautiful brown uniform and fit to kill. He acts like he's heaven's gift to the entire world.
Oh, I see. Is he a young fellow?
Not over 30. Shall I tell him you're too busy to see him?
On the contrary, send him in.
Uniform, and don't let him warn you. Go ahead, Mr.
Kerner. Dr. Paradise. Ah, Herr Miller, I'm glad to meet you. I am Karl Kerner, propaganda leader of the province of Saxony. Hi, Hitler.
How do you do, Herr Kerner? Won't you be seated?
No, thank you. I prefer to stand. Now, what can I do for you, Herr Miller?
Well, Mr. Hartman, an American friend of mine,
representative of the American soft drink manufacturers.
How did you know?
The Nazi party has a way of discovering such things, Herr Miller.
I see.
Well, Mr. Hartman tells me that
an environment in trouble, that he is afraid the authorities might drive him out of business, and he wants you to help him, yeah?
Yes, that's just about it.
That's precisely it, Herr Miller. Now, I am the man to extricate your friend from his difficulties. That is, if he wants my help.
I'm sure he would welcome your help.
Good. Then here is what he must do. Appoint me a member of his board of directors.
Oh, I see. And what salary would you expect, dear Kenneth?
$800 a month.
$800 a month?
Precisely.
Well, I'll have to consult Mr. Hartman about that. Are you sure you can help him?
Absolutely. I'm already helping 17 other companies who are having similar difficulties. I very much enjoy helping farm firms.
I see. It doesn't pay very much, but you like the work.
What a sense of humor, you American pals.
Yes, haven't we? No.
Persecuting foreign firms and then making them pay off to relieve the pressure is an old trick of the Nazi Party leaders. In the case of Mr. Hartman, his firm paid $800 a month merely to gain the privilege of staying in business. This would have been a bad enough bargain even if the Nazis had lived up to it. But Nazis never live up to their bargains. Hartman soon found this out. A few months later...
Hello? Just a minute, please. It's Mr. Hartman, Mr. Miller. He wants to speak to you.
Oh, thank you. Well, hello, Mr. Hartman. I haven't heard from you for quite a while. Oh, I thought you were paying Carl Trainer to take care of such things. Oh. Oh, that's too bad. Well, I'll do what I can. All right. Goodbye.
You beat that.
What's wrong, Mr. Miller?
Now the Nazis have ruled that Mr. Hartman's soft drink is Jewish and will pollute any pure Aryan who drinks it.
Oh, fantastic. Mr. Hartman's firm isn't Jewish. And even if it were, how could that possibly make any difference?
I know, Miss Ward. This Jewish line is merely a blind, of course. The truth of the matter is, Carl Kenneth's superior wasn't getting a big enough cut out of that $800, so we banged down on Hartman.
What's to be done now?
I think I'll go and have a talk with Dr. Lay, the head of the so-called German Labor Fund. Perhaps he can suggest some way out of this thing. So I called on Dr. Lay. This high Nazi official suggested that the American soft drink manufacturers pay the expenses of a Nazi delegation to go to the United States and investigate whether or not the soft drink was actually Jewish. In spite of the high costs involved, the American firm agreed and the delegation was sent. Finally, the delegation returned and made out a report that the soft drink was not Jewish and could be enjoyed by any pure Aryan without danger of contamination. By this time, the American firm had paid out a good deal of money in the hope that the troubles were ended. But troubles never end when one is dealing with a Nazi. In a few months, the Nazi officials who had been causing all the trouble came out with a ruling that even though the soft drink was not Jewish, it was still a foreign drink, and therefore could not be consumed by any true German. For the third time, Mr. Hartman came to me for assistance.
Well, what are we to do now, Mr. Miller? Well, Mr. Hartman, you might as well face the facts. You're trying to do business with totalitarians, and it just doesn't work out. However, you have one or three courses of action left.
And what are they?
Well, first, you can go to this Nazi official and see how much it'll cost you to have him change his ruling. But he's already blackmailed me out of thousands of dollars.
What are the other alternatives?
The second thing you can do is close your business and go back to the United States. And that's what I'd advise.
But you said there were three courses of action. What's the third?
Well, if a Nazi firm was in the same fix as you are, they might consider having the official assassinated.
Assassinated? Well, I wouldn't shed too many tears to see some of these people assassinated. But Americans just don't do those things.
No, but that's what you're up against. Face facts, Mr. Hartman. You can't do business with Hitler.
You have been listening to the second broadcast in a series entitled You Can't Do Business with Hitler, This series relates the actual experiences of Douglas Miller, who was for 15 years commercial attaché to the American Embassy in Berlin. Listen for the third broadcast in this series, which is entitled No American Goods Wanted. This program is prepared and directed by Frank Telford and brought to you by the Office for Emergency Management in Washington.
Beef tallow to make soap, but is good to use to make all your margarine.
Oh, I see. You've run into the Nazi regulation that forbids Germans to eat food grown in America.
That's it. And even though my tallow is used for soap, the Nazis insist that since it's remotely possible that someone might use it to make oleo margarine, it must be called food. I tell you, Doug, this whole mess is driving me crazy.
Haven't you a contract with the Nazis?
Contract? You know what they think of a contract.
Yes, the proverbial scrap of paper.
Well,
all I can do, Tim, is to get in touch with the Nazi party bigwigs and try to talk them into giving you a break. In the meantime, you just sit tight.
How do you do, Herr Lufthansa?
Heil Hitler.
Won't you be sitting?
Nein, I prefer to stand.
Oh. Well, now, you're familiar with the case of Mr. Dennison, Herr Lufthansa?
Quite familiar.
Good. Mr. Dennison wishes to appeal the ruling that forbids him to unload his cargo.
Impossible. Herr Dennison's behavior has been Mr. Spot of criminal.
Oh, come now, Herr Lufthansa. How is it you suddenly label criminal something you've approved of for some time? Furthermore, Dennison has a contract.
That violates national socialistic principles. And any such contract is invalid.
Oh, really? Well, why then did your Nazi officials in the Ministry of Economic Finance?
Because Herr Dennison deliberately deceived them.
Oh, now that's sheer nonsense. Will you please explain precisely what national socialistic principle Mr. Dennison has violated?
The eternally sacred principle that German blood be completely and forever linked with holy German soil.
Is there something unholy, then, about Dennison's beef tallow?
Yeah. It is edible. It comes from America. No true Aryan German can eat food grown anywhere but in Germany.
All right. I won't argue that point. But the tallow is to be made into soap. Defining it as food seems to me the thinnest kind of technicality and one with no other purpose than to evade your contract obligation.
That remark is insulting, Herr Miller.
But Mr. Dennison can't understand.
Nobody expects him to understand. He's mercenary and grasping, and intent only upon making money. How can he understand ideals or essence or sacred principles or what is most holy to the German people? However, ignorance is immaterial. The tallow will not be permitted in Germany, and that is final. Heil Hitler.
Herr Lufthansa, wait. Herr Lufthansa.
Oh, the pompous young madman. He actually believes all that rot.
Of James Dennison is only one of hundreds of similar cases. Germany was out to dominate the trade markets of the world. All of her satellite neighbors and her military victims were to cooperate with the Nazis in not only refusing American goods, but also in driving America out of the other trade markets of the world. The Nazis preferred to see Germans do without rather than purchase our manufactured goods. This harsh regulation was very hard on many Germans. I recall one very prophetic example. A German friend of mine, a kindly, gentle old doctor, who had bought an American-made automobile before Hitler came to power and consequently before the restrictions were enforced. I called on my friend one day and discovered he was in his car.
Oh, Father, I'm so glad you've come to see us. You are just the one to help us. Father! Now you have nothing to worry about. Herr Miller's an American, and all Americans are experts with problems mechanics.
Well, you flatter me, Colin.
I think the trouble is missing this thing here, Herr Miller.
Oh, the carburetor.
Yeah, the carburetor.
Hmm. Well, I'm afraid it's beyond repair, Doctor. You see this crack right across the face here?
Yeah, but there must be some way to fix it.
No, I'm sorry. The only thing you can do is to buy a new one.
Buy a new one? But that is impossible.
Oh, Father, does that mean we have
to... Your current automobile is useless to us now.
Doctor, you mean you must junk a $1,000 car for lack of a $10 part?
Yeah, American parts cannot be bought anywhere in Germany. The government forbids importing American parts. And nowhere else can I get the right kind of... what do you call it, the carburetor?
If you know how we saved our money to buy an automobile, tell me that. That the head doctor could be able to call an
occupation. And I've had it
for years. Father, perhaps if you talk to the party leader?
I already know what he will say. That I am unpatriotic. Then because I can't use the automobile, he would take it from me. for scrap, Herr Miller. Imagine.
Scrap?
Yeah, to make bombs and cannons.
But, Father, how will you be able to call now on all the patients? You have so many.
But I don't know. Since Hitler, everything is in Gusta.
But, Papa, be careful.
This automobile, Herr Miller, what a fine, useful thing it is you Americans have made. Useful to a doctor and useful to the patient who waits for the doctor when the delay means suffering and haste means healing.
But talk. Scrap.
To make something like this now into things to kill me. I've lived too long, Herr Miller. Times like these are not for me.
As the representative of the Ministry of Economics, I must tell you that you have been misinformed. Our regulations do not forbid Americans from selling automobile parts in Germany.
But none have been sold since Hitler came to power.
Yeah, that's true.
And Germans owning American-made cars now find it impossible to obtain parts.
Most regrettable.
Well, why then don't the American manufacturers take advantage of their opportunity to sell parts here?
Well, because they refuse to agree to the terms we offer. That's why I have it up.
Oh, I see. Well, may I ask what the terms are?
We can't offer cash, of course.
But I'm sure our manufacturers would accept a reasonable barter deal.
On the contrary, we offer them barter, they refuse. We will buy $100,000 worth of automobile parts for $100,000 worth of German goods.
Yes.
In addition, they will buy an extra $1 million worth of goods and pay for them in cash. Do you call that reasonable? Asking them to invest $1 million cash merely to sell $100,000 worth of goods? Tell me that. We feel it is a privilege for foreigners to do business here, no matter what the terms.
But these terms are so preposterous, Herr Goodreiter. If I may say so, they seem to me as merely one way of saying that you won't take our manufactured goods under any circumstances.
You may interpret the terms any way you like, Herr Miller. But since you refuse our terms, I feel terribly sorry for the poor Germans who will now be unable to obtain parts for their American automobiles. Perhaps in the future, the fools will know enough to buy German products. I did that.
American businessmen learned that except for certain war materials, neither the Nazis nor the helpless victims of the new order would buy products made in the United States. Now, I've been trying to show to what length the Nazis carried their trade war against America, to show they would never buy our surplus food nor our surplus manufactured goods. Nazi propagandists have proven this very same point, not by intent, but because of a blunder. On a certain day in March, 1941, in the New York offices of the German-American Commerce Bulletin, located at number 10 East 40th Street, one of the editors was glancing over the most recently published copy of the magazine when...
Ah! God be him! Wait! Wait! Come here at once! Oh! Wait!
I'm coming. What is the matter?
I thought you
could
cut out that
arc that you own face. What? Cut it out? Oh, nice. I did not understand.
You did not understand.
You
do not understand anything. We are ruined. Completely ruined.
But why? I have done nothing.
Nothing. This fine political prediction in the magazine and his face, he has done nothing. Will you please turn the magazine to place for him?
I have to do it myself.
I know, I'm not a fool. It is my own art to not face free that
all
I want.
All right, I am finding it. Here it is.
Good. Now, read what I have written.
Yeah. Germany, with more than 100 million people, could easily buy from the United States each year 3 to 4 billion bales of cotton, and a great variety of finished products.
Go on.
If reasonable and normal trade relations could once more be established between both countries.
Now, read your article on page 12.
Yeah, but it is not my article. It is Eric Neumann.
I know, but it is the one I told you not to print.
It's
street.
Yes, I'm right. All the Germans wish to do is to make ourselves independent of the outside world in the domains of foodstuffs and industrial materials. Or other products.
Here! Now, do you see what you have done? On page 3, we tell the Americans Germany wants their cotton and wheat and lard and meat and oats and finished products. And on page 12, we tell them just the opposite. That we don't want their foodstuffs and manufactured. Ach, you fool!
But that article is by Erich Neumann, Secretary of State in the German Ministry of Economics. It tells how he plans to take the American trade market away from them. It's true.
It's true. Why? We are not supposed to tell
the truth. But Erich Neumann is a high official.
But he wrote that article for Germans to read, not for Americans. I told you that
to
me. But I thought... You thought...
We are supposed to. We are only to obey. You can't do business with Hitler. Been listening to episode 3 in a radio series entitled You Can't Do Business with Hitler. This series is based upon the actual experiences of Douglas Miller, who was for 15 years in an embassy in Berlin. Listen to the next episode in this series, which is entitled Two for Me and One for You, and gives you the real inside story on a much-discussed subject, Nazi barter method. This program was prepared and directed by Frank Telford and brought to you by the Office for Emergency Management in Washington.
Ich
steh ich dann unten am Meer. Die Brandung schlägt an, man hört ferne Geigen. Die Palmen sogar im Rhythmus sich neigen. Hör ich den Klang der Gitarre. Ich kann es ja nie noch einmal erleben. Nur wenn dieses Lied klingt an mein Ohr. Getrübt ohne Grund, zerstört was der Freunden. Und fluchen die menschlicher Stunde rein, sie versäumten. Versteh ich ihr Leid sehr genau. Drum erspar mir den Klang der Gitarre. Lass die Liebe dir will nur daran denken. Hör ich den Klang der Gitarre. Oh ja, gib mir den Klang der Gitarre, bis ich gerne abhänge und wieder schaue. Dann genau, wie glücklich ich war, hör ich den Klang der Gitarre, hör ich den Klang der Gitarre.
This song is dedicated for all the Teds down in Yorkshire and New Orleans if they have some. Let's go, Teds.